Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the winner of this year's ANV Zero Award for Young Readers Literature from the Tulsa Library Trust. Rita Williams Garcia is the author of 10 young adult novels and other books for children. She teaches at the Vermont College for Fine Arts. She's won the Newbery Medal Honor Book Award, several Coretta Scott King Awards, and been a finalist for the National Book Award on several occasions. She's best known for her trio of books about the Gaither sisters, three New York City-born African-American sisters living in the late 1960s. The first book in the series, One Crazy Summer, tells the story of a vacation living with her estranged mother in Oakland, California, during the tumultuous summer of 1968. The second book, PSB 11, follows the girls during their return to their Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood during 1968 and 69. And the final book, Gone Crazy in Alabama, shares their family's root story in rural Alabama during the summer of 69. The books are rich with period descriptions of the people, places, and times of her settings. Her most recent novel, Clayton Bird Goes Underground, was also a finalist for the National Book Award and tells the story of a young boy's love of his blues musician grandfather and his music, and his desire to follow in his footsteps following the old man's unexpected death. Rita Williams Garcia will accept the Zero Award, talk about her writing, and sign books tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the Hardesty Regional Library. It's a free presentation. She'll also be presenting awards to the winner of the 2019 Young People's Creative Writing Contest during the ceremony. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Rita Williams Garcia, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much, and congratulations on the ANV Zero Award.
Well, thank you for having me, and I am feeling truly blessed about that award.
Let's start with your most recent book, Clayton Bird Goes Underground. It's a story of a young man who idolizes his grandfather, who's a blues musician. Very quickly in the novel, he loses his grandfather, and he's being confronted by issues between grandfather and mother and the complex relationship that a musician has with their children. I think. What was the impetus for Clayton Bird?
Well, you know, I always think about children who have these very strong relationships with elders, whether it's maybe it's an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, and sometimes they're separated. Maybe they move away, or maybe they're separated by illness or death. And when that child does not have that avenue to grieve, it really makes a mark on their soul. And so they're not as happy an individual as they can be. And so that's what I wanted to talk about, giving that boy that place and space to grieve and to express himself during the time of his grandfather's passing.
There's a whole section of the book where you see how the effect of grief unresolved is making in his life, and something he's not even aware of. Perhaps the other people around him are aware of it, and he doesn't understand it.
Yes. You know, sometimes we tell children to get over it, or we say, oh, it was just his or her time. You know, we're trying to make this kind of loss natural, but still there is that part in that child, in that person, that is just profoundly wounded, profoundly marked by the loss, and they just need their own little way of expressing themselves. And it might not be the way that we might see as healthy or that we might choose, but everybody has a way of how they connect and how they let things out, and we have to give them room to have that.
One of the things this book, though, is certainly we're seeing it from the protagonist, Clayton Bird's point of view, but we're also seeing it from the mother's point of view, too. She's lost his father. They've had a complex relationship because, you know, I think there's one point in the novel where she says, you know, I've had a father that cared more about music than seemingly about me. And yet she's grieving in her own way, too. And I think the book does sort of helps to describe to young people who may be going through this that, you know, grief shows up in a wide variety of ways.
Oh, it sure does. You know, usually what we do is we tell the story from one point of view, especially if it's a young child's story. It's told from that child's point of view or over their shoulder. And what I wanted to do was to give the reader access to something that not even Clayton had, which was his mother's point of view. And so that's a little unusual in a middle grade story, but I just really felt that there were certain things that Clayton wouldn't know. And I think this is the way it is with how we are with our parents. We don't really know them. We don't quite know their story. But yet, the lives that they led as children affect the way they might parent us, affect the way that we are as children if they have issues that are unresolved. And so I wanted to really show that his mother loved her father, but she felt hurt by him, and she did not have the same bond with him that Clayton had. And so they have a connection and yet a disconnect, and it all comes through Cool Papa, which is her father and his grandfather.
And, of course, music plays a big reason for that connection. Why make music that focal point for you?
Well, honestly, you know, it was something that a colleague of mine, author Kathy Appelt, said during a lecture. I was listening to her. I attended one of her lectures at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and she was talking about the blues and the deep down cry of the blues. And the minute she said that, I kind of zoned right out because I was feeling a story, and I knew I was going to tell a story about the blues, but I didn't know where it was going to come from until I saw a video of rapper and beatboxer, oh goodness, Dougie Fresh, and he was beatboxing and playing the harmonica. And I thought, you know, there's some crossing here between old school hip hop and the blues. Maybe I can make that work. Maybe I can find that deep down cry in both disciplines, in both forms of music. So it was an opportunity for me to kind of dig down into both genres and to kind of bring them together.
And when you get an idea like that, is that something you go about and research, or do you just let your imagination run wild?
Well, you have to do a little bit of both. Something should be so spirited and just really comes out of you in a way that is natural but yet unpredictable. But yet you have to know enough about what you're talking about so that people don't go, I don't think that's quite right. You know, you don't want to raise hackles and you don't want to give misinformation. So I've had to do a lot of research. I had to learn how to blow a blues harp or harmonica. And when all else failed me, I had my husband, who is a musician, close by, so I could ask him, honey, can I say this? And then instead of giving me a yes or no answer, he would do something like make a diagram of the circle of fifths or some kind of chart or something, and, you know, and give me the technical answer. And then I'd go, thank you very much. You know. But I had to really, in all forms, I had to dig down and really learn as much as I could so that I could just make all of those, whatever I learned, let them be a natural part of the story that could really find its own connection and not just something I was just adding in because, oh, okay, that's correct. That is music, you know. Try to really make whatever references I thought was needed, make them marry a lot more naturally.
I love the way you told the story because, you know, Cool Papa dies, I think chapter 3 maybe.
Yeah.
And so you're really telling the story about this wonderful relationship between the boy and his grandfather in retrospect. And I thought that was a really interesting way of telling the story of this relationship as he goes through the grieving process, as he sees the complex feelings his mother has towards this event too.
Yes, well, you know, her childhood soul is still affected. We get to, actually, it's in chapter 3 that we get to know something about his mother as a young girl and how she would wait for her father to come home. And after being so disappointed, she would always feel like, you know, if anybody asked me, he's been lost at sea. So, you know, we see all of this kind of thing build up within the mother. And so whenever Clayton and his mother are together, they're either having a very loving relationship, a loving exchange, and he is her angel, or they are at loggerheads. And it's because it's their both of their childhood traumas at war with each other.
I was struck by something you said earlier, you know, and it made me think, is this in your writing in the last four young adult novels, there's been a strong relationship between a child and or children and someone other than a mother and father. And I was struck by something you said just a little while ago. I was wondering if it was a conscious effort to write stories about caregivers that may not necessarily be mom or dad. Was that something that was conscious in your writing?
Well, I think for me, what it is that acknowledgement of a traditional family that includes elders. That's always important to me. The elder does not have to be the wise elder or anything like that, but that elder has always been kind of the support in particularly African-American homes, but I think that's a very universal thing. And so they, especially now more than ever, they allow the parents to go and make a living, because now you need both parents to make that living, you know. And then there's more opportunities for mothers, and so they're not in the household in the same way. So I have to not just let the child kind of just dangle on their own. I have to give them some kind of support. And I really like older people, especially now that I am joining ranks with them. So I tend to include them in the stories.
Well, you know, it's funny that, you know, we think of what's normal, and really it's only our generation where it was abnormal for an elder to be involved intimately in parenting, because prior to that and now increasingly today, elders have always been involved in multi-generational parenting.
Exactly. And then you also have the situation where now younger families are having a harder time to establish on their own. And so they do have to go back to the families where the parents were able to get those homes because of government loans or VA loans or what have you, or because the market rates were different. I mean, I know we're far away from a literary discussion, but it's how the real world kind of connects with how you imagine your characters and how they're living.
My guest today is Aretha Williams Garcia, author of 10 novels for young adults, several books with pictures and young readers. She teaches at the Vermont College for Fine Arts, and she's the 2019 winner of the Ann Vizero Award for Young Readers Literature, given by the Tulsa Libraries Trust. Program scheduled for Friday evening at 7 at the Hardesty Regional Library, where she'll read from her work, sign books, and give away the prizes in the Young People's Creative Writing Contest. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Before we talk about the previous books, which were a series of books, give me a sense of how you began writing for young adults. Was it naturally how you wrote, or was it a conscious decision on your part to write books for young people?
Well, when I was a young person, I've always loved stories and writing. And so when I was first really trying to get serious about writing, I was trying to write for adults, but I had very little experience in the adult world. So what did I know? And I'm talking about myself as an adolescent. But when I graduated from college, I had this story about a young girl who wanted to dance. And so this girl was 14, 15 years old. It was a while before I started to write for much younger readers, say from ages 8, 9 to about 12. I would say about 10 years ago. And that kind of happened because I thought to myself, I'm always writing about these very serious things, but I'm a very lighthearted person, and I had the benefit of having a childhood where I was a child and I ran around and played like a child, played hard outside. I'm an army brat. So I had a very different kind of childhood. And so I wanted to share some of that joy of childhood, or some of the experience of being a young child in the world. And I thought, yeah, let me start to write in this age group for this reader and see where it goes.
And what was the first efforts like?
So my very first effort was actually, well, I was going to say One Crazy Summer, but I did write a story before that. In 2004, it was published. It was called No Laughter Here, and it is the story of two 10-year-old girls. Now, it's a very serious subject matter because it deals with a controversial ritual of female genital mutilation or cutting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so with two 10-year-olds, you would think, oh, my goodness, how can you tell that story? And while that story was written in a very young voice, it had to be shelved for slightly older because of the subject matter.
Sure.
And that is where I said, you know, I think I do feel at home writing the younger voice, so let me just jump into it fully. And that's where One Crazy Summer finally came, which was about 10 years later.
Now, I've read One Crazy Summer in an afternoon just a week or so ago, and, you know, it was just a delightful book, I think, you know, for adults. And yet I obviously wasn't the target market for this particular book. But what I loved was it blended a period of American history with this very complex relationship with a mother who has left her children. They're being reconnected in the summer of 1968 in Oakland and the height of the Black Panthers movement. And yet these kids are, they're wonderful, charming characters. And it's a really wonderful story. What was the inspiration for it?
Well, I grew up in that era. I was 11 years old in 1968. And I remember so much about that period. So much is just kind of emblematic in my consciousness. I remember the Black Panthers. I remember a lot of the hippie movement and all of the protests. And I'm the daughter of a Vietnam veteran, and I saw my father go off to war. So I knew I wanted to do something in the 1960s. And I really thought about the Black Panthers, but I thought, okay, how do I make this for children? And then I remembered, oh, well, yes, they had centers where they had had classes and kids put on plays, and they learned a lot of the Black Panther doctrine. But most of all, they did a lot of community activism, and the breakfast program was one of them. One of the programs, and my mother used to say that she was a Black Panther, but what it was is she was a part of the anti-poverty program, and part of the Black Panther movement came out of that program. And so I thought, yes, well, yeah, I want to start there, but I want to do it from a child's point of view to talk about this very different part of civil rights, the Black militant era. Which really gets very little airtime during Black History Month. So I thought, why not take this small part of history and open it up for children to look at and explore?
It's told through the voice of Delphine, the 11-year-old, the oldest of the three daughters that are sent cross-country, as we would do back in those days, put your kids on a plane and go cross-country to Oakland to meet this mother they never spent any time with. At least the youngest hadn't, and the oldest knew of her as somebody who left pretty young, when she was very young. And when they come across this mother, she's anything but mothering. A very complex relationship unfolds.
Oh, yes, yes. You know, one of the things that I like about writing for children is just the acknowledgement that life is everything but simple, and that who your caretaker is really does have a great impact on who you are. And if part of that picture is missing, that might have an impact as well. And I thought, what if they went out there and she just didn't want to have anything to do with them? Doing all of these kind of what-if scenarios really made the story grow bigger and bigger. And it made me think, well, of course, because she would be part of the mother would be part of that movement of women that was not only trying to assert her own independence and her rights as a person, as a Black person, but also as a woman. And for a lot of African Americans, African American women, we are so much involved in the struggle of the people that we then become second or third or somewhere along the line, but not first. Well, here is someone who has put herself first, and we don't necessarily like her. And so it creates a situation for the characters, for Delphine, who has to now protect her sisters, but also provide for her sisters, and who also wants to know who her mother is, and to kind of negotiate love and respect, and, you know, and where do they align within each other? So yeah, it's a fun thing for a person as a writer to do, because it is complex and it isn't simple. And I think it's a way of respecting young readers, and the very lives that they have are all very different.
Again, an elder takes a big role in the story of these three girls. Their grandmother, Big Ma, is the one that has helped raise them and really sort of created a perception of who their mother was. And it's obviously one affected by the fact that this mother abandoned her son and moved west and left her little children. And then as this book progresses and then the two sequels, you see how this relationship was far more complex.
Yeah.
And obviously this is why you kept coming back to this story. Well, so as far as I can see, this is the only book that you've written in multiple volumes about single characters. What was it about these three girls that you wanted to keep coming back to?
Well, I hadn't planned on doing that. I like to, I always say I'm from the James Brown school of funk and fiction. I like to hit it and quit it. I like to write intense and short and just kind of hit all the bases and leave them with this kind of vibration. But every time I got in the middle of one crazy summer, I began to hear the story of the father, the story of the uncle. Everybody's story kept coming at me, and I thought, oh, my goodness. Oh, I guess I'm not going to be able to leave these characters alone for a while. So I knew in the middle of One Crazy Summer that I was going to have a sequel. But it wasn't until I got to the end of One Crazy Summer that I went, oh, no, there's going to be a third book. So it was a surprise to me. But once I got it, I made notes as I continued to write so that I would kind of say, okay, we're going to open this up because I'm going to deal with it here. But it's okay if they completely forget about it in this book. That's okay. And it doesn't matter whether they pick it up from there, but I just want to make it as intentional as possible. And so the story and the characters, you know, I just felt that, okay, they're opening themselves up to me. Let me follow.
Of course, One Crazy Summer, it's the place plays so much of a role in this story. You have three streetwise young New York girls heading to California, thinking of Disneyland instead being plopped down in the streets of Oakland in the summer of 68, and that plays a big role in this first story. The next story, PSB 11, is back into Brooklyn. Or Bed-Stuy, I guess, the next school year. And then the last, Gone Crazy in Alabama, you're in Alabama in the summer of 69. And again, these are really rich places to mine as far as location.
Rich in historical and social context and content. When the Black Panther Party really began to open, it was in Oakland. And so what better place to drop these girls than in the hot, what does Big Ma say? The hot pot of trouble cooking, Oakland, where there were shootouts, where you could see Black Panthers with rifles patrolling and marching in the streets, and where there were rallies. And so as much as there was activism that the girls would have seen, they would have also seen some of the things that Delphine was noticing,
as she read the newspapers and as she looked around, that yes, this is a place where it was dangerous, where it was potentially dangerous, that revolution wasn't just doctrine, it was also potentially bloody. And so so I have kind of a responsibility to my readers to let them know that there are the different facets of the Black Panther Party and the movement, that you had the community activism, everything from sickle cell anemia testing, tenants' rights, health exams, food baskets, and just all kinds of social benefits. But none of that stuff came free. People were out there marching and fighting and potentially defending, as they would put it, defending themselves against, for the most part, against the government, against police. It was very violent times. Yeah. So Oakland had to really, I really wanted to create that, but yet not have people feel excluded from what was going on. I still wanted them to be invited in. And with Brooklyn, when they came back, I figured, well, you know what? There are going to be changes. There will be changes within their home, changes going on within themselves, changes in their community. Because now in Bed-Stuyvesant during that time, you know, Robert Kennedy, Senator Kennedy, had come out there many a time to kind of give hope and to open up programs, to talk about education and poverty and, you know, those kinds of social things. And so a lot of that was going on. So you had the women's movement also going on and Shirley Chisholm running, and you had Bella Abzug out there. So you had a whole women's movement and things just changing and what those changes meant for the home. And then I had to send them down south, which was where their family was from within these United States. And so that was yet a different climate, yet still the volatile 1968. And while they were going down to a slower environment, still there were things going on. You know,
true.
The Ku Klux Klan ran, would ride through town. And my grandmother used to tell me stories about the Klan riding through town. She was from North Carolina. And so the more that I read, the more that I said, oh, yeah, that has to be there, because that was still going on. So that you could get kind of a sense of what that whole movement of revolution and change was like, but yet not so much that it hits you over the head, but that you can see as if you were experiencing it yourself, as if you were a friend or a relative of Delphine, Vanetta, and Fern, and you could see through their eyes, you know, what they saw and what a lot of their grandparents saw. Because I think these days a child who is about 10 years old, maybe their grandparent might be 60 or a little younger,
right.
You know, so they might know a little something about that.
Well, young people have benefited from those wonderful novels. And congratulations again on the Zero Award. We look forward to your appearance in Tulsa. And congratulations. Rita Williams-Garcia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rita Williams-Garcia is the winner of the 2019 ANV Zero Award for Young Readers Literature. She'll be accepting the award, talking about her writing and signing books tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the Hardesty Regional Library in South Tulsa. Her most recent book is titled Clayton Bird Goes Underground. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.